You're listening to TIP.
In today's Q4 2022 Mastermind episode, I invited Tobias Carlyle and Hari Ramachandra. As always, we talk about the most interesting stocks on our radar, but we kick off the episode with our thoughts on the current market conditions. Toby is pitching a stock with a solid downside in uncertain times. Hari's pick is down 70% year to date, and we're discussing whether it's a falling knife or a bargain opportunity. I only have four individual stocks in my portfolio, and I'll be pitching the most recent stock I bought last quarter. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as we did.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
Welcome to the Investors Podcast. We're here for the Q4 2022 Mastermind meeting. And as always, I'm your host, Dick Brodersen. And today I'm here with Tobias Carlyle and Hari Ramachandra. Gents, how are you today?
Very well. Thanks, Dick. Thanks for having us. Good to see you, Hari.
Hey, good to see you, Toby and Stig. Thanks for having us, Dick.
So, Hari, we usually bring a pick to the table, and we're also going to do that today. But you suggested just before we hit record that we should talk about the current market conditions. And a great idea. I mean, what a market that we're in right now. Let me throw it over to you to begin with. What are you seeing in the market right now?
This is Toby kind of a market. Like, you know. So I know Toby is very restrained today, but I'm pretty sure he is enjoying this market, and I would love to hear his take on what does he see. And like, for example, I know, Toby, you have been skeptical about Bitcoin and the hyper growth stocks for a while. What I really appreciate is your grit and your patience, that you took a stand and stuck to it. So first off, I wanted to kind of, you know, get your thoughts on what do you see. And in a way, you're vindicated on many, many issues. So I would love to know how you are seeing the market today.
Well, thanks, Hari. That's very kind. I think about it in two terms. One is the stock market and one is the underlying economy. So in terms of the underlying economy, you know, there's a lot of moving parts to it. We had the COVID shutdowns and then the COVID restart and all of the stimulus that went into the economy. And I think that that created, well, that's got this, it's had this twofold effect that there are still parts. And my pick today is going to be about a company that has been impacted negatively by all of the things that have happened, you know, supply chain issues and the rampant inflation, cost of raw materials. And on the other side, I think that we're sort of moving through that now. So for this company, I think that the near term looks better because it's going to work through those things. And I think that that's true of many things. I think the inflation spike that we've seen does have there's a big secular component to it, which is one of the reasons I'm very sympathetic towards the view on Bitcoin. I'm not anti-Bitcoin in any sense. The Bitcoin maximalists who say it's, you know, a way to escape the money printing, I'm very, very sympathetic to that view. It's just I don't have any particular ability. You know, when I sit down at that table, I'm the patsy. I don't know whether 20,000 is a good price or 2,000 is a good price or 200 is a good price. So for that reason, I just avoid it. But one of the really telling indicators for the underlying economy is the treasury yield curve, which is they just take, you know, there are treasuries that run out to 30 years. So we issued 30-year treasuries and we can see short-dated treasuries that are issued. So we can take it anywhere from 1 month and we can look at the yield on the 1 month. We can look at the yield on the 3 month, on the 6 month, on the 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, 10 year, every single year out to 30 years. And what ordinarily happens is that you get paid a lot more, you get a lot more yield to hold the 30 year for the obvious reason that you don't get that money back for a very long period of time. A lot can happen in 30 years. You're going to have a lot of inflation. You're going to have a lot of changes in the stock market, changes in interest rates. And so that's called duration. You get paid to hold duration. And ordinarily, you don't get paid much for the very short-dated T-bills. They turn over very quickly. You get a lower interest rate for holding them. And that's called backwardation, where as you go further back into the yield curve, you get paid a little bit more. Now, every now and again, something very odd happens in the market when it gets spooked and people don't want to hold the short-dated paper because they think that something bad is imminent. And that means that when you don't want to hold an asset in order to find the next best person who, or the next person who wants to hold it, you've got to pay them a little bit more. And so we're in this very unusual period. It doesn't happen very often, but it has happened on occasions where all of the dates that you hear, you will recognize these dates, where the front months, so the 3 month is typically what people look at, and then they compare it to the 10 year, which is the typical, you know, you might think about that might be the rate that you might use to discount a company at. That's people thinking sort of 10 years, that's about the right amount of risk and duration for a company. And so the 3 month currently yields more than the 10 year. And so that's called an inversion. And so when the 3 month yields more than the 10 year, typically what that indicates is that in the shortish term, like in the next 6 months inside the year, that's got a very good track record of predicting recessions. And so what it's indicating now, well, Cam Harvey is the gentleman who did this research. He published in 1986. He looked at all of the inversions pre-1986. And so we've had that as a live signal that's been working forward since 1986. And it's got a fantastic record. It's not had any false positives, and it's had no false negatives either. So it's been quite a good predictor of these things, and it's currently inverted. For Cam Harvey's signal to work, it needs to be inverted for 90 days, and it's only been inverted for about a week. So it hasn't triggered Cam Harvey's signal. But you can pull this data up. It's all available free on the Fed's website, on the Alfred website. I direct link through to this, so I couldn't tell you exactly how to get there. But you can look at these inversions, and there was an inversion in 2007, 8, 9. There was an inversion predicted in 2000. There was an inversion just before March 2020, which is really odd. Like that 10-3 inversion predicted the COVID crash, as funny as that sounds, but that's the case. And we're currently inverted now. So the signal's not triggered, but that inversion is typically pretty bad news for the stock market as well, because the stock market sort of has these two types of crashes. They have a valuation-driven crash, which ordinarily it pulls back about 20% when that happens, which that's the technical definition of a crash, but they happen reasonably frequently. And then they have these much deeper versions, which is like a 2000, 2002, 2007, 2009, where it can be 40, 50, 60. I think the average in that period is about 40 to 45%. We're currently down a little bit over 20% since the start of the year. I have this other metric that I like to look at where I say, I look back 12 months, so it's year on year. And I say anytime the market is down 20% year on year rather than from the peak, that's what I define as a real crash. And so that was triggered in 2000, 2002, 2007, 2009. And as of today, that is also triggered. So what that indicates to me is that there is some real weakness in the underlying economy for the very obvious reasons. We're probably at the end of a business cycle. We've also gone through a very unusual period where industry was shut down, industry was restarted, there was a flood of money that went into the market that just created this explosion in asset prices, explosion in commodity prices. And a lot of that is coming back, explosion in house prices, and a lot of that is coming off now. When people look at how you sort of determine a housing market, determine a recession, that they have this acronym HOPE. So the first thing to go is housing. Housing is the first valuation to roll over. And I think housing prices have come off pretty significantly from the high, which you could say that was a sugar high from all of that liquidity that flooded in, plus people being locked down in their homes, all that sort of stuff. And so now we're coming off that comp. So that might be an unusually high comp. It might not really count. And then the end of that is employment. So when employment actually dips, that's sort of the real teeth of the recession for most people. That's when most people know that there's a recession going on. At the moment, employment hasn't rolled over. Here's the really sick thing about the stock market. Because it's a forward-looking metric, it's a forward-looking sort of mechanism, rather. The stock market tends to fall over at the very beginning of, it's like housing, it'll go when housing goes. But the stock market will take off when employment finally rolls over because it looks into the future. And it can see that once employment starts coming down, then we're near the end of that cycle and there will be another up cycle that comes after that. But because we haven't seen employment rollover yet, I think we're right in the middle of like an air pocket, where because we've got the 10-3 inversion, the stock market's down 20% year over year, all of these other things are rolling over. I think there's a very good chance that we see sort of a near-term volatility that will lead us into quite a nasty drawdown and potentially a nasty recession. I take no glee in that. It's just that's what happens. There are business cycles. We go up and we go down. I'm always very careful as an investor because these things aren't really predictable. And I'm adding a lot of narrative to this that probably doesn't really exist. They're a lot more random than I'm making it sound. But I think we're going to go into this period where probably asset prices are going to come down a lot, housing prices, stock market prices, everything else. That'll clear the decks. We haven't seen any big blow-ups yet, but I'm sure that anybody who's heavily levered into this is going to get hurt badly. And that's why when I invest all the time, I'm always worried about this kind of scenario, because if you can't survive this kind of scenario, then you don't get to play on the other side when it becomes very good. And so I'm always hyper-focused on just making it through to the other side. That's why my picks, you'll always hear when I say something, when I'm picking it, I would rather something that has no downside and a lower upside than something that has an enormous potential for upside, but also an equivalently large downside. So my picks, and today will be another example of that. It's just, I think it's a solid business that will muddle through and it'll do okay. And there's a little bit of optionality embedded in it, but I think the downside is virtually zero. So that's my two cents. Thank you for that kind intro there.
So thank you, Toby. That was very well summarized observations. I was actually taking notes while you were talking and a few things caught my attention. Number one, you talked about business cycles. And first question is, how much of it is Fed-induced versus general organic business cycle in play? Number two is, how much of it is being controlled by Fed? What I mean by that is, if Fed pivots or loses its resolve, do you think economy will just snap back, or you think that it's beyond Fed's control right now? And number three is, what are the risks of a liquidity crisis like 2007 happening again? In this environment, we saw Credit Suisse and Bank of England having issues, and in general, England or UK having issues with their gilts market. So what's the risks of another Lehman Brothers?
If you go back pre the introduction of the Federal Reserve, there used to be a lot more business cycles. We used to have a shorter business cycle, and there used to be a lot more crashes. And so that might sound bad, but they tended to be a lot shallower. And what that meant was that businesses tended to run holding more cash than debt. They just tended to be more robust because they had to be, because there were regular business cycles. It happened every 2 or 3 years. You had little boom, little bust. It never got too far away from kind of the underlying true growth of the economy. Since the Federal Reserve has come in and they've managed that, we've tended to have much longer business cycles, but they've also got much, much further away from what you might call the underlying kind of valuations. I don't know if that's good or bad. I think that it's bad personally, but there are lots of other smart people who think that's good. So I don't really know. But I would say that there is a natural business cycle, certainly, and I don't really know what drives it. Animal spirits, something like that. Cooling weather, warming weather, imports, exports. It's such a complicated engine, the economy, or a complicated organism. Any little thing, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings and then you have the tsunami on the other side of the world. I really do think that happens in the stock market. You never really know, or the economy, you never really know what is driving it, which is why I think the interventions without understanding what is happening is just lunacy. But that's the scenario that we have. So what the Fed was set up to do initially was, you know, banks run heavily levered, so, and they don't have cash on deposit for everybody who wants to pull their cash out on any given day. So if there's a line down the street of people who want to pull their cash out, banks used to fail for that reason. So the Federal Reserve was introduced to make sure that if they all got together collectively and there was a bank run, you could have liquidity from one, there was no problem anymore, you get rid of the bank runs. Unfortunately, we gave the Federal Reserve, its two mandates are full employment and stable money. And I think they failed miserably on both. So why we continue this experiment is sort of beyond me. They don't follow any algorithmic rule. There's no sort of, you know, the Taylor rule is like an idea that they should follow to set rates. And I know that Greenspan used to follow the gold price. They don't seem to do any of those things. Your guess is, like, there are lots and lots of intelligent people out there who understand all this stuff, who watch what the Fed does, and it doesn't make any sense to them. Like, they set interest rates too low for too long, in my opinion. And now they're ramping. I don't know how the federal government's going to be able to afford to pay. I don't think they can. So it's not going to be ramped for very long. It's going to come back down. But there is an underlying weakness in the economy beyond what the Fed is doing. You know, typically what we've stopped hiking when the Fed funds rate have exceeded inflation, and we're way, way below inflation at the moment. But there's a cyclical component. there's that bump in that inflation that's going to come down at some point. And also, we don't really know because we're kind of measuring this stuff looking backwards. So, nobody really knows what's going on. So, the answer to your questions is I think that there is some, there's going to be some cyclical weakness. That's just genuine. That has to happen. What the Fed can do to deal with it, I really don't know. Like hiking into it seems silly to me, but they've got no choice because they've been trading, rates have been so low that they've got to give themselves headroom in order to pull it back down in due course. I think that what will happen, and if you look at 2000, 2002, 2007, 2009, when they started cutting, that was right near the top of those crashes, and they cut 10 or 15 times in each scenario, and the market proceeded down. However, the first time they cut, the market did spike. So, there's a chance that they cut, market goes up 15%, then everybody says, wait a second, all the prices are, everything's much more expensive and the underlying problem's still there. And so, that's when the market really gets loose. And that's the scary, that's the chaotic time, which is the scariest time in the markets. When that chaos starts, though, the thing you got to remember is that it is pretty short-lived and that's when you get the really best prices. The disaster is to sell out at that point. You've just really got to understand that you're going to look dumb, whatever you do, you're going to be sickened and you're going to have the adrenaline running whenever you're looking at the portfolio. But you're now in the part where the forward returns getting good. And forward returns are now much better than they have been for a long period of time. It's just that I think we've got to go through this moment. To answer the final question, I don't really know. That's been I've asked that question to a lot of different people. And the answers, everybody seems to think that the banks are in a much healthier position than they were in 2007, 2009. So that's a good thing. They've got a lot more capital. They resisted because 2007 and 2009 was so bad. They resisted any of the silly loans, although those loans, those low covenant, covenant light, all those sort of really levered loans, they did finally emerge right near the very end. So, all of that's probably a donut. I don't think that the banks are going to be quite as badly affected, but they do hold a lot of residential real estate, and residential real estate is probably going to come back a lot. So, their loan to asset ratios are going to look more gnarly. So, I've seen statistics like we've had as many big down days in 2022 as we did in 2008 and 2000, which were sort of the worst few years in the last 20 or so. And there's really no panic. You know, there are a lot of vol guys out there who are struggling because there's been no vol. Like, they're basically long vol, the tail risk guys. They're waiting for that to happen and it hasn't happened. They kind of think that that market's broken. I don't know. I viscerally, anecdotally, I don't feel any panic either. And here we are off 20-something percent since the start of the year. Like, that's pretty gnarly. But I think everybody was just like, well, we were up so much last year and the year before and it's just part of the cycle. And so, here we go. At some stage, though, there must be some body that floats to the surface. There's somebody out there who's heavily leveraged, who's got assets that have been cut to smithereens. Hopefully, it's not systemic. I don't think it'll be systemic, as could be famous last words, but I don't think that's going to be the problem. I think that this is basically just a plain old, it's not a credit crisis so much as it is just a plain old overvaluation plus slowing business cycle leads to a pretty big drawdown. And then you come out the other side and you keep on going. So, we're probably, once this actually kicks off, and I think we're kind of, I would say now-ish is when we're really kicking off. Once it does, it's sort of 3, 6, 9 months of chaos and then it'll all be good. But I think our next few quarterlies will be quite interesting because I think we'll have something to talk about.
Toby, what a way to kick this off about the current market conditions.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host 2 live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show. Perhaps we should start looking at the different picks. Hari, let me throw it over to you.
Yeah. I'm actually just flying right into the eye of the storm with my pick, Stig and Toby, because my pick, I had a different pick before I came in. I think I emailed you guys, like, and I have two, but not able to make up my mind. But today I have made up my mind. It's going to be Meta. It's in the news. It's in the eye of the storm. The stock is beaten down. Zuck is a pariah now in the Wall Street. So some feel he has lost his mind. And Facebook stock is down significantly. It's, I think, at the levels of 2015, something. So it's essentially wiped out 6-7 years of its market cap. So today it is 235 billion market cap. It was flirting with 1 trillion, not so in distant future, or in the past, I mean. And when I look at their earnings call transcripts from the earnings call, their most recent earnings call, their fundamental business, that is Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, overall, there's no red flags. Their monthly active users, daily active users are healthy. Their engagement is healthy. Their overall revenue, if you adjust for the currencies, it's actually slightly higher, 1-2% higher. And they are also innovating. Like, I know that TikTok is a great threat to Facebook, Instagram ecosystem. Snap is also coming at them, but they have Reels is picking up. And they're also experimenting with WhatsApp to become like WeChat, or what Elon Musk would call as the X app that he wants Twitter to be eventually. But I think Facebook is actually further along in that process. In fact, they're very successful in India. They're actually piloting that concept in India first, and it's picking up. A lot of e-commerce is happening on WhatsApp over there. They're also introducing monetization in WhatsApp. And in fact, anecdotally, I can tell you, a lot of international calls now just happens on WhatsApp. A lot of business happens on WhatsApp and the Facebook ecosystem. So they are tying up the two. So but there are headwinds like Apple's data privacy policy. And in reaction to that, they are investing heavily in AI to make their algorithms better for ad targeting without Apple's data. But I guess what spooked the markets is the bet on Metaverse. And what spooked them even more is actually the Metaverse. When they look at the product with Zuck and his associates walking around without legs and the graphics, and what people are asking is billions of dollars and this is what you're going to get. I think that's a That's actually a very good question, because when you look at many of the games today, which are played on desktops or any of our gaming consoles, have a much more sophisticated graphics, which almost looks real. But what we fail to understand is that Meta is actually trying to build on a new platform, which is the VR system. Hence, it is in a much earlier life cycle compared to what we have in the 2D graphics that we see on most of the gaming console. But having said that, I'm myself not sure what is the use case or business case for Metaverse yet. The way Facebook is projecting, like Zoom replacement, doesn't sound that exciting, because now people are going back to office, even though not all days, but it's more like a hybrid situation right now. Gaming, again, having to wear it, there are folks who did that experiment to kind of wear it for extended period of time. They felt nauseating, was not a pleasant experience wearing it, as you feel disoriented. So the business case is not yet clear for Metaverse. Maybe it's too early to say, but when you have a bet that you're making, if you look at any of the companies like Amazon or Google, when they're betting on a new project, they won't bet their company on it. I think that discipline somehow is not being displayed by the management at Meta. And they want to continue to double down on Metaverse. I think that is the biggest tail risk, in my opinion, that if we are putting good money coming out of their traditional platforms into something that might not work out in the future, and with the dual classes in the shares, nobody has any say in the company's direction. I think that is the tail risk, that if they don't listen to markets and they don't listen to what the customers are saying, and they continue to plow in money into this Metaverse and it results in nothing. Some estimates is that next 10 years they might plow in $250 billion into this experiment. So that's the biggest risk. So I hope I'm not shooting my own pick, but I just want to lay out the risks. But having said that, right now it is trading at, last time when I looked, close to 2x revenue. Their revenue is around $118 billion and their market cap is $235 billion. And if you compare it to any other peer like Pinterest or Snap, they're all trading at much higher price to sales, even though they're less robust business. If you discount Metaverse completely, just the traditional Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp platforms. So with that valuation in mind, it's almost selling like a classic Buffett style value stock, maybe. Maybe not, but I guess Stig and Toby, I would like to get your opinion on Meta.
So to your point, Hari, I like the valuation. I don't like the company. Spoken like a true value investor, I guess. It looks very appealing. Like we are looking at what, high single digit price to free cash flow or something like that. It looks attractive. But I also think that there's a reason why it looks attractive, and that's typically how the market is doing it. I remember that we talked about Meta a few times before here on the show. We talked about that it was probably the weakest of the big tech companies. And I do think we have it on record, because it's always easy to, you know, to be a Monday morning quarterback. But I do think we talked about it before. And it seems like even though all the big tech companies are in a lot of pain, that Meta is the one most in pain. And I think there you can paint some color around some of that. If you look at online advertising right now, and I know that Alphabet or Google, they just went out with their quarterly reports, and they also was punished by the market. And I'm, of course, biased because I invested in Alphabet, but they're just holding up a lot better. Like if you look at the increasing competition in online advertising, we've known for quite some time that Amazon continues to grow fast, and they are. Now Apple and Microsoft are doing the same, even though it's still very low. We have to talk about TikTok, how big a move they made in just 2 years. And it's mainly from Facebook or from Meta's platforms. It's not so much from Google. I think it comes down to that Facebook's platforms are just not good. And I keep on using Facebook and Meta interchangeably here, but Meta's platforms are just not as good. And I'm sure a lot of people use them all the time and they would disagree with me. I think there's just a different stickiness to something like Alphabet's, Google's platforms, compared to what Meta is doing, even though that you know, we talk about the engagement and all that is good. And I see some of that in whenever I look at financial statements for Meta, whenever I look at the margins, not so much at the gross margins, I can't help but compare it to Google. Like, you know, they have the company X, or they call it the Moonshot Division or whatever they're calling it. And they have, you know, one that graduated, like Waymo. That's not how Mark Zuckerberg is playing ball. Like, it's, we got to bet on black or red, or, you know, it's just a very different format, which I don't think that they're necessarily leaving online advertising because that's how they make the money. But like, they're getting beaten up right now. And so continuing on that note, I would like to talk a bit about cognitive biases, because I'm going to talk about a stock here a bit later that has continued to drop in price, and still I'm going to pitch it. And Hardy is doing the same thing. So I hope you don't get offended in any kind of way, Hardy. I kind of feel like I'm talking about my own cognitive biases. And I kind of feel Meta is a good example of that too, because, or perhaps it's a good example of that too. It's down at the time of recording 73% this year. And the pick that I have is also down by quite a lot. But the reason why I wanted to bring this up is that I listened to the episode that William here on this feed did with Andy Duke on his show, Richer, Wiser, Happier. It was episode 15. And Andy Duke talked about this study from the Wharton School of Business, where they looked at analyst earnings projections. And what the study found is that whenever a stock analyst have made a consensus forecast and the earnings came out differently, they had no problem updating the forecast. But if the forecast was not a consensus forecast, they did not update their own forecast. They decided to double down on that. And the reason why these stock analysts were so susceptible to that was because they'd done that in public, sort of like what we're doing right now. I can't help but just bring that into the mix right now, because later on, I'm going to talk about Chinese tech. And as we all know, that's going extremely well right now. So I have a few different points about this. I'm saying it because I'm worried that I'm susceptible to that. I wanted to bring in for Hari to consider if he's also susceptible, because he's been on record talking about me before. But I also want to say, sort of like to try and save Hari and myself, that we have to consider, like, what's the valuation? I don't know about how you invested, Ari. I didn't buy Chinese tech at the top or Meta at the top or anything like that. We have to think about what's the valuation, what's the price today? And that's the discussion that we're having. So, Ari, Toby, I wanted to throw it back over to you guys.
Full disclosure, I hold Meta, and I've held it. I bought it this year. I don't know exactly what price I paid for it, but I think it was about $160. So I think we're down almost half on that position. I thought when we bought it at 160, that if you just took all of the labels off and you just looked at the financial statements, which is essentially what I do, the underlying financial statements show that is an incredibly good business. It earns an enormous amount on the capital that's invested in it. It's growing like a weed. A lot of it falls through to the bottom line. A lot of it falls through to free cash flow. Zuck's got so much money there to play with because they make so much money. And Zuck has been an absolute machine at buying stuff. He bought Instagram for $1 billion, which seemed like absolute lunacy to me at the time. And I think that he clearly underpaid by some monster margin for it. It was a genius acquisition. WhatsApp, stupidly overpriced when he bought it. Now, you know, one of their biggest properties. So I think Zuck is super smart. He's got all of his skin in the game. The underlying financial statements are incredible. I think when I first bought it, I thought it was worth 300. I think it's worth a little bit more now. Could be 330, 340. Could get to 390 if I was being silly. I wouldn't value it on that basis, but I could get there. I might not sell it before it gets to there. So I think that the business is very, very good. I think that Zuck is very, very smart, and he's had some wins. But I do agree that the risks are, and I should say, all of these positions in my portfolio are about 3%. So I never size anything very big. So if I'm right, doesn't really do much for me. If I'm wrong, doesn't really do much for me either way. I'm sort of relying on the overall performance of the portfolio to generate the returns. And that's sort of a quantitative systematic approach to investment, which is the way that I do it. So I'm never going to be as far into the weeds as someone like Harry is. So I like sitting there and listening to Harry talking about it. It forces all of my priors, hammers that in further. I run the screen. It's still in my screen. I still think it's super cheap and it's a cash flow beast. The problem for every investor is I'm investing on the basis that the future looks like the past, and I'm not very good at working out where there are going to be these pivot points. And clearly TikTok is incredibly addictive. I had TikTok on my phone for a week, used it just to test it out. I had to delete it off because it's incredibly addictive. I don't think it's doing great things for the minds of the youth in the States, but you know, it's a free country, do whatever you want. I do have Instagram on my phone and I use that and I love it. I like looking at my friends' kids' photos, stuff like that. Like that's, and I like sharing my own kids' photos and that's sort of what I use it for. And I use it for other things too, like checking UFC fight scores and other things like that. I think it's a great tool. I think Twitter's a great tool. I use WhatsApp all the time. The metaverse looks really junky to me. I don't know how they're going to get there with that. I don't know what they're going to do. Zuck seems fully embedded in it, but he's got, there are some cool things. He's got this little wristband that you can put on that it'll see your gestures. That stuff's super cool. There are lots of cool little ideas in there. I wouldn't want to bet against Zuck, but you've got no choice because you kind of welded into the cockpit with him there, and there's nobody who's going to get him out. His shareholding's too big and he's got different voting shares, so you're stuck in there with him. I like Facebook quantitatively, and I think it probably does work out given a 3 to 5 year timeline. Having said that, all of the reasons that people have identified for why it could fail, I think are absolutely real risk factors and probably does, you know, explain why it is going to trade a discount to those valuations that I said earlier. However, at $90, where your upside could be 300 plus, I think you just, to have a bet on Zuck and that mind control machine that he owns, I think you're almost paid to take it here.
Just to piggyback on that, Toby, you know, it seems like everything in tech is just being beaten up, and a lot of it for good reason. And as we all know, we talked about it before here on the show also, that whenever the interest rate go up, whenever you discount the cash flows back to today, that's why you see all these tech companies be in a world of pain, because a lot of those cash flows are out there in the future. But to your point before, Toby, like this is really attractively priced. Like we're looking at free cash flows of what, trailing 12 months, like almost $10, fiscal year of 2021, like close to 14. Like this is, we're not talking about cash flows that are way out in the future. We're talking about cash flows that we have right now. Whenever I'm worried about Meta, I'm worried about way out in the future. I'm not worried about the next 3 years. And I think that's also really important to understand whenever you're evaluating this company and other big tech companies that might start to look more reasonably priced. Whereas some of the beatings that you've seen on tech companies without almost no revenue or at least losing a bunch of money, yes, it makes a lot more sense why they're getting beat up.
They are doing a buyback too, which I should mention. That's one of the things that attracts me to it. And I think that the only complaint that I would have, and I can't second guess the operational guys who can see the horizon in their own businesses better than an investor who's outside who has no idea. But I would say that if I could redirect that $250 billion towards buybacks, that's what I would be doing.
Thank you, Toby and Stig. I really appreciate you alerting me on cognitive bias. And to Toby's point, so my position in Meta is also very small, insignificant, that it doesn't impact either ways, up or down. So it's part of my kind of, you know, what I call it as my private index. And the reason I brought it up today is not just as the company, but I'm more focused on the valuation, because I do see a lot of headwinds for Meta in general. I think, Toby, you brought up a very good point about, I think maybe it was Tig, about other players like Netflix and Hulu getting into the advertising market, because they are now going to have free but ads service. For that, Toby, that segment is a direct competition to YouTube, not to Facebook or Instagram. So it's a different genre and a different use case. But having said that, I think your point is valid. The way I see it, it's a zero-sum game, because advertising doesn't grow faster than GDP. For the past 50 years, if you see, the ad share of GDP has been stagnant. It's like some fixed percentage. So all these companies are kind of, you know, fighting for the same advertising money. The first losers were newspapers and television channels, because these tech companies took away that money from them. And now they're fighting among themselves for that limited pool of money. So yeah, so I think that is the risk here. And I think Zuck is trying to get out of that trap of just being stuck in the advertising with metaverse. Like whether he will succeed or not is a bet. So I think my reason for picking up Meta for discussion today is, one, I wanted to know what do you guys think, obviously, and at this price point. Two is, the question is, has the market discounted all this bad news and all the risks? Like the way I see is, if I see a DC of 10 years from now, write off $100 or $200 billion of metaverse fantasy that Zuck has, and then value it to current levels. Like, am I getting fair value?
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
All right, let's talking about the next stock. Would you mind, Toby, if I go next?
Just that we're no, absolutely
in that,
not.
We're in that genre with beaten up stocks that just continue to drop. So I'm going to pitch my own stock here. So I think I mentioned in the previous mastermind we had, I think at the time it was just you and me, Toby. I think Hari was stuck somewhere in India at the time. And because we were talking about this small Danish company called North Media at the time. And I said, oh, I have like four stocks. And then you were like, what? Why you only have four stocks? That sounds silly. And it probably is. I've recently taken a small position in a company called Prosus. And I do mean small. I think it's like 1% and change, something like that. But I am considering doubling down. And I hope I am aware of my own cognitive biases because it's continued to drop, which either means that now it's really cheap or I'm just making one stupid decision after another. But it's this company called Prosus. It's a big Dutch company. The market cap is 93 billion euros. And despite the size of one of the biggest European companies, it is not that well known. It's a global consumer internet group and one of the largest technology investors in the world. It is majority owned by the South African multinational company called Naspers. That's probably a bit more known. And they have this weird ownership structure. So they're sort of like, they have a cross ownership structure. That's the way it's called. So sort of like they own each other. Prosus is probably best known for the investment in the Chinese company Tencent that Naspers originally made. They made the investment back in 2001. They bought and hold on 46.5% of Tencent for $32 million. It was not billion, it was $1 million, I said. So it's widely known as one of the best, most successful venture capital deals of all time. That being said, I just want to underline that it would be an oversimplification to say that an investment in Prosus is just a more, call it, accessible investment in Tencent. There's so much more to Prosus than meets the eyes. And I just wanted to preface that before you go like, oh, are we going to talk about Chinese tech again? Like, haven't we heard that broken record before? So the way I would phrase this is that I would look at Prosus three different ways. I have three different components to my bull thesis of this stock. Number one, the stock is trading at a heavy discount whenever it's a NAV, it's the net asset value. Number two, Prosus is actively making sure that it's trading closer to NAV. And three, the NAV are trading at a significant discount to intrinsic value. And so those are my three bull theses for that. So let me just try and break those three up. So the first one was that the stock is trading at a heavy discount to NAV. And so as of today, the stock is trading at 46 euros and the NAV is 82 euros. And we have to keep in mind that 3/4 of Prosus assets are listed assets. So in other words, it would be more expensive for you to buy this list of stocks that Prosus own. And so you can more think about it as that you bought Prosus stocks, you would in addition get, you know, private assets on top of that. And the listed assets is, as I mentioned before, 3/4 of that. So it's something that the market has already priced for you. The second thing I want to talk about is that Prosus is actively making sure that it's trading closer to NAV. Prosus is very well aware of this discount, and it's a wide discount. You know, NAV is 82 euros at the time of recording, and the price is only 46. So it's very, very big. So what they're doing is that they're selling Tencent stock to buy back own their own Prosus stock in the open market. And it effectively also means that if you own, say, one Prosus stock, you would actually own a larger share of Tencent, even though the company is selling off Tencent. It's just math, really. It also, of course, own a bigger part of the unlisted assets too. And if you have to break down the third component to my bull thesis here, is that the NAV is trading at a significant discount to intrinsic value. So in other words, I think that the intrinsic value of the stocks you're gonna hold are just a lot higher than what the market are pricing it at right now. So if we look at the assets of the balance sheet of Prosus, it's 110 billion in net assets. We have, and this is in euros, 83 that is in listed assets, and of those, 70 billion is in Tencent. The remaining 26 in unlisted assets, and then the rest is in net cash. So doing an intrinsic value of Tencent is just a bit beyond the scope of this pitch. I kind of feel it would be a very long, and perhaps if it continues to drop, I'm going to talk about Tencent in the next mastermind, who knows? I would say that Tencent is trading at least 50%, if not more, discount to the intrinsic value, even given everything that's happening in China. Of course, I could be completely wrong on that assessment, but that is my thesis going into this. But it's also very important to emphasize that even if I'm wrong about what's going on in China, even if Tencent is truly worth as little as it is right now, given all the beating it's been getting this year, I'm still very much bullish on Prosus. It might be a, call it, smaller double-digit return you will get, and not a, I don't know, 30% return, whatever, depending on how you want to make your assumptions. But like, we don't have to be right about Tencent trading at a lot discount to their intrinsic value for this thesis to pan out. I also wanted to put some words on the unlisted assets that Prosus have. And so it comes in various categories: classified, food delivery, payment, fintech, edtech. Those are the bigger categories. I'm a bit cautious about how I value that. The way that they list it is that it's the sell side valuations, and then the average, it says like it's the average consensus of the sell side analysts. But even in my assessment, I just marked that down with 30%, just giving the current environment we're in and just wanted to be cautious. That's not really where the value is. Prosus have a good track record. They made more than 800 investments, 120 of them are unicorns. I do want to say that we have to consider that with a grain of salt, because they are really, they toot that pretty proudly. But I'm also thinking, as the size of the company and how much money they're swinging around, they have to invest in relatively big companies, and in a low interest environment, a lot of them by definition would just be unicorns, so or turn into unicorns pretty fast after that. So if you follow the venture space, you just have to consider that. It doesn't mean that, you know, they did the seed funding. They definitely did not do the seed funding for those companies. So it's not like those companies necessarily did like 1,000x, but they obviously have a good track record.
I love the idea of the triple net discount. I guess the question is just going to be, how likely are they going to be able to get any value out of that Tencent holding? Isn't that the big risk here for any of these China stocks, is that they just sever relationships with the West? And I don't know how realistic that is. That sounds insane to say it, but it's definitely that seems to be the predominant risk for all of these positions, doesn't it? Is there any way to handicap that? How reliant are they on it? Are those other holdings, are they enough to kind of bail you out?
I think that they are. And going back to the point I had before, like if you look at, let me just pull it up right now here as we're talking. So yeah, we have net asset value of 110, and this is in billions of dollars. So Tencent is 70 out of 110 right now. And it's proportionally becoming less every day because they're buying back stocks in the open market all the time. But you are right. You need to have a relatively good grasp of what is Tencent worth before you might see this. I do like that they're bringing in their own catalyst. And I guess I'm just beating that drum, but that they're selling Tencent stock to buy back their own stock. So to me, other than just looking at evaluation as its own driver, having that catalyst in itself is just very valuable to me. If we look at, let me go to that point about how they're being severed from the West. Really, to start shooting myself in the foot here, I want to throw it back over to Hari, because one of the things I wanted to talk about with this pick is what has been happening with what came out here October 7th, whenever the Biden administration came out talking about that we had to ban the export of microchips. I'm trying to understand the chip market a bit better. It doesn't work that well on a podcast here, but I have the Chris Miller's book, Chip War. Still can't say, I understand the chip market that well, but it is interesting that China spends more money importing chips than they do on oil. I just kind of feel that's a fun fact. So I guess my long-winded question here to Hari is, how big a problem is that for China, given that China is also, and Chinese companies, that they're fighting for supremacy in AI, but also in turn that in a way they are competing with the West in a way that they're not, because that's just not their market. You know, I don't know what this would mean for the cloud business, but I can't see, regardless of how good their chips are, that you have Western companies want to store the data in China and vice versa. So Hari, let me throw it back at you. How big of a risk is that for a company like Tencent?
It's a very interesting pick for sure. I was trying to decide whether it's a proxy for Tencent or is it a baby SoftBank based on their investment. So what we tend to forget is that the majority of the design of these chips happens in the United States, even now. The manufacturing is mostly in East Asia, China, and Japan. And if you look at the distribution, the high-end is manufactured in Japan and Taiwan and US to some extent. Mid-end is manufacturing in Singapore and Malaysia, low-end in China. But the most important thing that most of us forget is there's a lot of machinery that is required to manufacture these chips, whether it's low-end, high-end, or mid-end. All those machineries are mostly from United States, companies like, the name is skipping me right now, but they're all in Silicon Valley. And there are some in Europe, especially some of the chemicals required in this manufacturing comes from European companies. None of them are in China yet. China has not been able to manufacture or make machines that make these chips yet. They can operate well, and that too on the low end. US restricting chip sales to China for advanced chips is actually a geopolitical decision, which is the right decision to make from a geopolitical perspective, but may not be good for those companies. I think Peter Zeihan has this wonderful book, The End of the World, It's Just the Beginning, where he talks about how the last 20, 30 years was actually an aberration. I think globalization was kind of an artificial state, an experiment that looks like is kind of winding down.
What a shame.
Thank you, Hari. That was very insightful. Let's look at the stock price of Prosus. It's trading at 46 euros. I would put the intrinsic value at least above 100. I could probably even make the argument why it would be 150 to 200 euros. But then we also have to consider the probabilities of that actually coming into effect. We've seen some funky stuff happening in China recently. And one of the things that I'm looking for as an investor is, when does the market confuse risk and uncertainty. Whenever I look at what's happening with COVID, like everything, every time something's coming out with COVID, it's typically it's something that's negative in China and they're strengthening the grip. Like all the Chinese tech stocks just like taking a dive. And it's for good reason and it's not. The reason why it's for good reason is obviously that it's not good whenever the Chinese economy is not thriving. Also, we have to consider that Chinese tech companies they're not hit the same way by COVID as other companies, even though it's obviously not good for them. But it seems like whenever I'm doing my discounted cash flow analysis, it's almost like these companies, Tencent and Alibaba, we couldn't mention them, they're almost priced for China will shut down indefinitely. I think it's important to distinguish between that risk and that uncertainty. I would argue, and perhaps I'm biased, that it's very uncertain whenever China would open up again, but it's not uncertain that it will happen. If I look at more about some of the things that has happened where it just seems like everyone is just very bearish, Xi Jinping, the president, got reelected for the third time, which is a bit weird, and like the whole constitution had to be written for that to happen. But like, I think Alibaba and Tencent went down like 14%. And I tried figuring out why. Was the market surprised that he got the third period? No. I think the market would be shocked if that didn't happen. One of the arguments that was flowing around was that Xi Jinping talked about common prosperity. I'm sorry, haven't he just talked about that for 2 years now? Then there were others that said, the Politburo was sort of like the executive committee that makes all the decision. He have continued to like put yes men in there who would not overrule him in any kind of way. And he was anti-capitalist. And to me, it was like, yes, that's how the system works. Wouldn't you be more surprised if he had put in business people who would actually have the authority to overrule his decisions? Like, I guess I was just a bit surprised how something that to me seems so obvious, just looking at an outsider into China, how that could spook the market like that. And we also did see a bounce afterwards. It's sort of like also to one of Hari's points, like, has it been discounted into the price or has it been like over discounted into the price? I find it hard to believe that whenever we get bad news from China, that should continue to send down the stock, at least at the magnitude as we're seeing right now. And then I want to go back to the point I said before about big tech. It's very important that we don't just call all tech. It's really important that we look at the individual. You're not necessarily just discounting cash flow that's going to happen sometime in the indefinite future. You are discounting very real cash flows that are there right now, plus the other catalysts that we're talking about. So to me, no, the company is not as valuable as it was beginning of the year. But the valuation and this discrepancy between price and valuation is a lot more appealing than if we're looking at the beginning of the year. Let me throw it back over to you for a lot of bashing. I'm sure my pick deserves it.
My concern in general is two things. One is about Tencent. I'm not really worried in the long term about how Tencent will do, even though they might have headwinds like demographic situation in China, where by 2030, or 2040, their population is half of what it is today, based on the latest stats. In fact, China admitted that they overcounted their population by 100 million. And that means these are all childbearing age cohort, basically. That means there'll be even fewer children going forward. So I think that's a serious problem for China, actually, from an economic perspective, which US doesn't face. Comparatively, I'm saying, it's like, it's not as bad as scenario. So that might impact companies in China in the long run. But I'm not talking about long run. In the next 5 to 10 years, the concern is not about Tencent's economic viability. The concern is whether Western investors, as Toby said, will be allowed to hold any Chinese stocks if there is a regulation that kind of, you know, disallows any foreign investor from holding Chinese stocks. Then process will invariably have to write off that 75% holding. I don't know whether that's going to be a reality. Obviously, that's a far-fetched possibility and most likely not probable. That's number one. Number two, what would be interesting is if they liquidate all their Tencent holding today, which is 75% of their holdings and entire asset base, and then just hold cash and invest in something else, would that be something smart thing for the management to do? And in that case, would process be an amazing investment today? So that is something, Stick, you might want to address. And those are the things that kind of, you know, comes to my mind. Go ahead, Toby.
Yeah, I like everything about the pick. I just, in these sort of triple net or the derivative kind of arbitrage place, you just need a lot of patience. You need to be able to sit there for a long time and hold them without sort of knowing when they're going to work out. That's the only sort of downside to that kind of investment, but that's true of most investments. I just think you've got that one unhandicapable risk and you're probably getting the price now where it's worth doing that. But then I would have said that with Alibaba too, probably a little bit higher than where Alibaba is, but never going to pick the bottom. I like the pick. I like talking about that, how you handicap that risk with China. I think we're probably at peak pessimism now, and we're probably, when some of that pessimism rolls off, people will regret not having bought it when it's kind of obvious that Prosus is even doing something about it, selling it down. So I don't have sort of much in the way to add to it, but I think the discussion's a good one around it.
There might be some different concerns. We definitely see the SEC do a lot of things to regulate the Chinese companies. It feels different here in Europe whenever it comes to that. And I did a little digging, also because I have a stake in Alibaba, and like what would happen if it was delisted and all that. And it seems at least here, we don't have the same issues in terms of if that were to happen. That like three different things that could happen. But in any case, like you as an investor won't be without any money. You can be forced to buy it back and you can get holdings or you can be transferred to another broker where you would then get it. Like there are different ways where you still get that. It sounds really bad whenever we talk about, oh, can you then even own it? But whenever you do the digging, you still can.
It's not about valuation risk. I think you're right. Maximum pessimism has been built in. You might be getting it for a really good value. The only thing is regulation risk. I think that can just, your share of the company will be zero. It doesn't matter what the company is doing then. So that's the risk I'm talking about.
To be fair, you have that in the States though too. There's this windfall profit tax they're going to bring in on energy companies. Look at what energy companies have earned over the last 15 years. They haven't made much money and we're underinvested in energy.
Yeah, I agree.
Regulatory risk all over the world.
Yeah. And also, what you said about policymakers looking out for themselves, I'm sorry to say that's not I do agree that's a huge issue in China, but I also have to say you also see that in Europe, and then I won't make any comments on the States. So I'm going to go throw it over to you, Toby. Also want to hear from your pick.
I will do this fairly quickly. My idea is Colgate. Everybody knows what Colgate is. I'll give you the headline and then I'll get into the detail a little bit. But the main idea is that we discussed at the start of this program, Colgate is a consumer staple, very consistent, and it's a $60 billion market cap, $68 billion in enterprise value, which means it's got net debt of about $8 billion. Revenues are about $17 billion this year. Gross profits are about 10. Operating income about 4. And then the bottom line's about 3. So on an EV EBIT basis, you're paying about 22 times. Sounds reasonably expensive, but gross profit margins are about 60%. It's under earning a little bit at the moment. It's about 16% return on invested capital. In 2017, it was about 23%. So it's declined quite a lot because it's had these headwinds, and particularly so over the last few years where all of its input costs are, its raw materials are expensive, transport's been expensive, wages have become more expensive. I think it's had everything thrown at it at an operational level. And it's still a pretty good stock, having seen all of that. All of the brands are all very well recognized. They've got great pricing power. They earn about 22% of their revenues in the States. They get about 16% in Asia, which is a much more fragmented market and looks like they've got quite good growth proceeds. It's there. I think if you looked at, it's got about a 3% dividend as well. All of that taken together on a sort of quantitative basis, looking forward, assuming that it sort of goes back to what it has historically earned on its assets, I think that over the next sort of 3 to 5 years, it'll do mid-teens kind of returns compounded from here. I think it's very defensive. I don't think you downside as much. People tend not to steer away from these sort of relatively low cost, even though they're high margin, they're all relatively low cost purchases for them. The business is in four parts. There's oral care, which everybody knows. They have home care, personal care, and this pet nutrition business, which is the more exciting part of it. And so I have owned Colgate for a while. I owned it before Third Point took their position into it. I knew that this business was inside Colgate and growing pretty, because this is a material part of their business, but this is the sort of optionality that's built into something like this that moves it from being potentially a mid-teens compound return to being quite a bit more. Third point, you know, they're an activist firm. What they want them to do is to spin this business out, because they think that there are very high multiples being paid for, like a 25 to 30x for this pet care, pet nutrition business. Financial engineering, I used to find that really fascinating. Now, I think it's probably just as good inside this business as it is outside this business, but you might get a bump if they can persuade, if Third Point, who've been a very effective activist, very good firm, very good investors, very effective activists, have had quite a lot of success, although I think the Colgate board is unlikely to take too much notice, but you never know, anything could happen. So there is this sort of optionality built into it. But the idea is that this is Third Point's idea. There's this, it's called Hill's Pet Nutrition, and they own these two brands that are doing very well, Hill's Science Diet and Hill's Prescription Diet. I see them advertised all over Los Angeles. They make up about 20% of Colgate's sales and an equivalent amount of their profit. But given that Colgate itself trades on a 22 multiple, and you could get, if this is spun out, it might come out to 25 to 30 times multiple. That's where they're saying is this sort of found value in this thing. So you get a little bit more on about 20% of their business. If you add, well, they've been investing in this business pretty consistently. They've bought three pet food manufacturers around the States. They've been reinvesting to say all of the problems that they've had with inflation and the strong US dollar and supply chain issues and all of those sort of things. They've been working on these problems, and they've been investing in the business to sort of ameliorate these as best as they possibly can through some product innovation and other things like that. But the idea is that this thing, this business is worth about $20 billion and spun out. It's sort of close to found value. You'd lose about 20% in profits to find $20 billion. So that's some upside. I am happy to hold this thing at a mid-teens return, given that the downside is virtually nil, but there is that sort of optionality built into it. So just to summarize, it's like a mid-teens return, 3% dividend optionality in this Hill's business. All of the other businesses they're consumer staples. They're things that people don't spend a lot of money on, but buy very consistently, and they're hugely profitable for Colgate. And Colgate has a lot of non-US growth potential for the foreseeable future. So that's the pitch. It's a very simple one. It's a high cash flow generative business. They've got a lot of levers to pull, sort of from a financial engineering perspective. They've also suffered through sort of pretty substantial headwinds, and at some point those will reverse and they'll have the tailwinds. And so that's the pitch. I don't think it's going to be as racy as the other two, but potentially there aren't as many sort of hairs on it either. What do you think, gents?
Yeah, interesting pick, Toby. And it does feel like a classic Toby pick too. But when I was looking at your thesis, is it fair to say that the catalysts that you're looking at are, one, the pet foods, that's an optionality that it might grow, bring in some revenue growth? Because when I look at the revenue, it's almost flat. It's not growing. Last 3 years, if I look at their last 3 years of revenue, like it went from around like 15.7 billion to 17 billion. But their net income is actually down, like from 2.3 or 2.4 billion to 2.1. So I'm assuming that you're thinking your thesis is that the pet food business will bring in some growth, and because of the activist investor, they might actually increase their EPS. Is that
how? That's right. I think there are two things going on. My thesis was originally, before Third Point initiated their position, was they had all of these headwinds, and you can see, I would say it's since 2017 to date, last 5 years. Return on invested capital has fallen from about 22, 23% to about 16%, which lowers the valuation sort of commensurately from my perspective. It goes from being worth, you know, that differential is about a 25% haircut. And I can see that reversing. They should get back to earning on their invested capital what they have in the past. The margins have been, like, it's surprising. Gross margins have fallen to just below 60%, which is kind of extraordinary that that's the quality of that business. But they have been operating in an environment where they've had all of those headwinds, and that when those headwinds reverse, a lot of that will fall to the bottom line pretty quickly. And they have various levers that they can pull to sort of maximize that valuation, buying back stock and so on. There is this other, this is only a reasonably new, I don't know when their letter came out. It's only in the last month. The third point letter is only in the last month or so, where they say, plus there is this found value. And they say it's 20% of the revenues, 20% of the bottom line, but potentially $20 billion on a $60 billion market cap. That's very material sort of potential list in it. I don't know how you handicap it. I don't think it's particularly likely that it happens, but that pet food business is growing much faster. It's growing at sort of, I think it's like 11% growth a year. And that's it has all of the same problems that their other businesses have with those cost issues, which is why they bought the additional factories or pet food manufacturing facilities. And I think that you'll see some improvement over the next few years, and that should result in a re-rating in the stock as well. And then you have the potential for that upside from the third point spin-off, but I don't think it's a likely outcome.
I always like Toby's picks. And if I can highlight a difference between Hari and my pick and Toby's pick, and I don't want this to come off in any kind of wrong way, and I kind of feel it already is because I already started saying that, is that Hari and I, we invest our own money. And I also know, Toby, you invest your own money together with your investors. But your pick, Toby, is very much like an asset manager pick. And I mean that in the best possible way, because you won't get into any trouble with something like Colgate. You just won't. There is a reason why it only dropped, 14% year to date. And something like Meta dropped 73%. Now we're talking about, could we, for our own money, do that? And then if the thesis plays out, it could do like 4x. And don't get me wrong, I also know you have Meta in your portfolio, Toby, and you can diversify, you can have a lot of different things in your basket. But I just kind of feel I wanted to say that whenever you hear what might seem like crazy picks, like really understand what kind of investor are you listening to right now? Investing their own money, someone else's money, what's their method of investing? I guess that was the first thing I wanted to say. One thing that I wanted to touch on for Colgate was inflation. We are looking at inflation being a real concern, especially for all of us, and also for a consumer goods company like Colgate. As a product group, you would probably say that the products are generally price inelastic, which is just the economist's fancy word of saying that they're not as sensitive to price increases. But that is as a group. Like, we still need food, we still need to brush our teeth, we still need, you know, all the basic things that they're providing. But in that category, it can be very, very price sensitive, especially in a time of inflation. And so if you go through the earnings call and they talk about we are either number one or number two in all the categories, and like it's very fragmented, like all the things that they do, and that's probably true. I don't know Colgate's products as well enough to say how big the moat is. We just also know that consumers are hurt right now and they are very sensitive to pricing. So whenever I'm looking at the margins, you can already see that for Colgate right now. With the gross margin, it's in decline. Obviously, the operating margin are too. And whenever you are looking at very price-sensitive products, it's very difficult to push that over to consumers because everyone sort of has to agree that you keep the prices high. It's illegal, by the way. And so that's one thing that I would probably note. And so it's not because I'm not optimistic about Colgate. I think they will do well as a company, but I would expect a lot of margin to be squeezed over the next few years whenever you look at the multiples. So I'd probably be a bit more conservative than some of the numbers that Toby called out in terms of the return, but Toby's usually right. That's what I used to say here on the show.
That's very kind. I don't know if I have been particularly right recently, but I think that a lot of the margin squeezing has gone on because there have been, you know, there's been this big transition away from people buying national brands in supermarkets and spending lots of advertising money and paying up to get the space in an line of sight, getting the end caps in the supermarkets. And that model is a little bit old. We don't really, now sort of people will buy over Instagram and they'll find things in different ways and they're prepared to put black charcoal toothpaste and do all those sort of other things. But a part of that is a little bit of that is the amount of VC that has flooded into these different areas. And that is now going to be going heavily in reverse. So I don't think that there'll be as much competition from new players. There'll be that sort of established, more genteel Marquis de Queensbury boxing rather than the bare knuckle street fight that they've been in. I think that the main story for Colgate has been that cost pressure. And a lot of that has been, you know, everybody seems now to think that the transitory argument for inflation has been sort of debunked and inflation looks a lot stickier and is going to be here with us to stay for a lot longer. And I do agree that inflation is much, much higher structurally now than it has been or has sort of seemed to have been. I think that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. So the amount of money printing sort of does eventually end up in asset prices and consumer prices. And now they're going backwards a little bit. They're quantitatively tightening, so they say. There's been a lot of quantitative tightening rhetoric and not a lot of quantitative tightening until very recently, but now it does seem to be there. So the cyclical transitory component of their cost pressures is going to go away. And for something like Colgate, which is run pretty efficiently and is run pretty close to about as tight as they can run it, all of that does impact them. They're doing about everything right that they can get. There's not a lot of place that they can go when they find those cost pressures. So when they get them, it impacts them. But when it reverses, it'll have an equally sort of ameliorative effect on their ability to earn and generate revenue. Sorry, ability to generate profits on the bottom line, almost regardless of what the top line does. The top line is going to be like inflation. The top line is going to be like 5 or 6% for the next few years. I don't think it'll be particularly impressive, but it won't be going backwards. And with that cost discipline and the cost pressure, and the inflation is across everywhere, transportation, raw materials, wages, that is going to keep on being an issue. We're not going backwards. We're not going back to where we were, but I don't think that we're going to see the same explosion in those prices that we've seen over the last 2 years. So I think you're getting a reasonably good price to take that bet here. But I do acknowledge everything you said. I agree with that 100%.
All right. Hari, any comments? Anything you want to add before we round up the show?
No, nothing to add from my side.
Well, guys, as we are rounding off the show here, as always, we would like to give you the opportunity to give a handoff to anything you do to the audience and where they can learn more about you.
Okay, so I'm always around on Twitter. Hari Rama is my handle, and my blog, bitsbusiness.com. Look forward to engaging with the audience there.
I run Acquirers Funds. The two funds are the Acquirers Fund, ZIG, which is a mid and large cap deep value fund, and DEEP, which is a small and micro deep value fund. It's the same strategy in both, just divided between two different universes. And I have a website called The Acquirers Multiple, which has got a free screener for these sort of stocks. And I've written some books. They're under my name on the Amazon page, but the most recent one is The Acquirers Multiple, which is $10. You can read it in 5 hours. It's written to or 2 hours. It's written to a fifth grade reading level. It's a really easy read.
Jens, it's wonderful always having a chance to go this back and forth on stock picks. Thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me, Stig. Good to see you again, Harry.
Yeah, thank you, Stig and Toby. Always fun to hang out with you guys.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network and learn how to achieve financial independence. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.